I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Ask DJ Spooky what sets him apart from other DJs, and he'll admit he doesn't fit the normal roles of Beatmaster. He is, as he says, a man with a lot of information streaming through his mind. Well, add to that stream the 1915 silent epic film Birth of a Nation, with its images of noble white Klansmen saving the fair-haired women of the South from the scourge of black supremacists. Put that on the DJ's table and watch it turn. Once DJ Spooky was finished sampling, remixing, and editing his version of Birth of a Nation, it was, well, not the film that D.W. Griffith had intended. His were very powerful images, considered so racist that even today screenings of that film are picketed in America. The DJ calls his version Rebirth of America. We'll talk with him about the new cut, but we're also talking in broader terms about those streams of information, where they come from, where they go. We're a long way past the grandmaster manipulations of vinyl here. So what's the story, now that scripts and silent films and historical voices are all a part of the production? If hip-hop really became the CNN of young black Americans, then where is the cultural narrative today? If no work is truly original, well then who's consuming, who's producing, and who's creating? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest is DJ Spooky, also known as The Subliminal Kid, also known as Paul D. Miller, author of the new book Rhythm Science, touring the world right now with Rebirth of a Nation. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Can I call you Paul?
Oh yeah, Paul.
Because that whole AKA thing is going to take up a lot of space here. There's a something that I read which told me your relationship, your going back to Birth of a Nation, actually came from a recent political election, the 2000 election, 2004. What's the link there?
Well, you have to remember, Birth of a Nation is one of the first films to show a dramatically flawed election, which, of course, those of us who are in the more progressive blue areas of the country tend to look at the last couple of elections as with dismay. But there's also a sense of how do you understand the process of propaganda, manipulation, and, of course, election irregularities that occurred in the South in the Civil War Reconstruction era. But if you look at some of the issues that parallel that, whether it's the Florida election scandal of Gore versus Bush, mm-hmm. or some of the irregularities around the voting machines and stuff like that of the last one, these issues still kind of haunt us.
There's a funny kind of thing going on with Birth of a Nation, though, and it happened to me yesterday as I was watching a little piece of it. I turned to somebody and I said, Is this documentary footage or is this... do you know what I mean?
Sure.
You look at those old jerky, jumpy, black and white images jump across the screen and they look like newsreels, mm-hmm. as much as they look like a feature film.
Well, it's interesting because Griffiths was commissioned by the U.S. Through President Wilson to work on helping propagandize World War I as well, to kind of create film and cinema to help promote people to join the army to go to the war and stuff like that. All of which are current, if you look at Iraq and, the amount of TV advertising for recruitment posters for the military as well. So these are strange moments of kind of links between historical and current issues. So,
that's the fact that Birth of a Nation is really just somebody's fictional story about something that might have happened but didn't in many ways, it is... We look at it as a piece of genuine history?
Yeah, that's what the trick that Griffiths pulled down over people's eyes was that it was originally believed to be the true story of the South. But of course, in our era of historical revisionism and, all sorts of different issues around whether you're in the South and they're now pushing creative design, mm-hmm. in school systems.
Intelligent design.
There we go. Not too creative, but intelligent. this is the era of, it almost seems more like going back to Griffith than ever before. So I'm kind of highlighting that in the film.
Now, the music that we're listening to right now is music that you use over the scene that you were describing earlier of the flawed election, mm-hmm. in Birth of a Nation. We're joined on the line by Elvis Mitchell. He is former film critic for the New York Times and a visiting lecturer at Harvard University. Have you had a chance to see the new version, The Rebirth of a Nation, Elvis?
Yes, I am.
Tell me what it does to your notions of the original film.
Well, I think what it is what I really like about it, and I think the way it actually relates to hip-hop, is that it basically keeps art in a state of flux. there's a sense of momentum and movement and recapturing of ideas. The other thing I have to remember about Birth of a Nation, too, is it's based on a novel. And it's sort of Griffith's kind of imagining of that novel and bringing to the screen what President Wilson at the time called, you know, history written in lightning. And the sad thing about it is that it is true. It's the power of the medium that the president of the country was going on about the enormous kind of spiritual and emotional power of that movie, and immediately imputing that it had to be true because it was up there on the screen. So when you had the president of the United States at that time essentially confirming the worst of people's fears on screen, it was kind of astonishing and naive in the same way that I think our current president can be naive, and I'm being diplomatic here.
So from both of you here, though, what happens when you take something like Birth of a Nation and you digitalize it, and you take it apart, and you put it back in a different way? What happens to it, Paul?
Well, the remix, you have to remember, this is the era where even gangs have their own DVD production units. There's recently been a series of spates in like Baltimore where gangs did a series of videos, DVDs called Stop Snitching, which has kind of caught a lot of funny buzz on the scene. They did a demo showing what would happen if you snitch to the federal authorities, in the same way that Muslim fundamentalists in Iraq are making videos of their own executions, or et cetera, et cetera. This is the era of media literacy. So all of these groups, whether you're a government or whether you're a gang or a terrorist cell making a propaganda video, you know, these are all about creating your own story. You know, so who's to say which one is real? This is getting more and more fragmented. You have Al Jazeera versus Donald Rumsfeld. Who do you believe?
Where does DJ Spooky and the Birth of a Nation fit into all that, though?
Well, okay, Griffiths, if you had President Wilson believing the story and then using that as a megaphone to say this was real and this was history, then you're left with a populace that is totally uncertain, because the leader of a nation state is saying this is true, so then obviously it has to be real, right? The remix says, look, there's multiple perspectives on all of this, and history is always a battlefield of truths and half-truths and uncertainties.
So, Elvis, are we still fighting those battles about what's true when we look back to as far back as Birth of a Nation?
Well, I don't know if fighting the battles as much as now. I think we kind of, in a lot of ways, surrendered that battle, because so many people now, even in history classes, movies are used as a way to teach history in high school history classes. You know, Oliver Stone's version of JFK is treated in the same way that Wilson treated Birth of a Nation. So I think what's important about, again, just talking about this as being a kind of a cultural history that's constantly in a state of movement, and what Paul is doing with that is remixing it in his own way. But there are major filmmakers who do that. Certainly, George Lucas every couple of years does essentially his own remix of Star Wars, and I think we're worse off for them. You know, it's not a bad idea. I think what it really does is it falls into the real kind of tenet of hip-hop, which is to democratize an art form.
That's a connection that I want to hear, Paul, you speak a little bit about, is you know, if we boil down hip-hop to back to your original days as a DJ, draw the line between that and taking something as sort of monumentally classic in an awful and a sort of technical way as Birth of a Nation. Is it the same kind of thing that you would be doing in a club? Do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same strategy of composition. And if you look at, say, for example, a lot of early Soviet cinema, Sergei Eisenstein, what he called dialectical montage, you know, that kind of sense of cut-up narrative. If you look at the Beats in the 50s with William S. Burroughs, what he called the cut-up technique, or Jack Kerouac's kind of stream-of-consciousness narratives, all of those have migrated in from the avant-garde to become part of the basic fabric of youth culture. So video games, website design, a lot of these issues are about selection and code, and then also moving between found environments, you know, if you're moving down a corridor or up or down. Mm-hmm. But with sound, moving with found bits and pieces of records, you know, you have to remember this is something that a lot of kids would love to participate in more, because if you think about it, I think I was reading an article a little while ago, turntables now outsell guitars. As it used to be, the kids wanted to play a guitar to be the next guitar hero, but now they all want to be scratch battle masters or whatever. So,
Elvis, I want you to write the sort of opening line of the next chapter of film history here. Are people going to say 5 years from now, you remember when DJ Spooky did his own version of Birth of a Nation, and that will precede a whole sort of switch over to people reproducing or producing their own stuff out of all the video that is there on the shelves to be had now?
Well, I mean, I think what this actually means is that it frees people up in much bigger ways, because as Paul knows, this has been happening for a while. There is that great remix of George Lucas's Phantom Menace that basically a fan took and made his own version of that movie, removing Jar Jar Binks from the equation, which is certainly not a bad idea. And I think basically sort of offering people a kind of permission in a larger sense is a great thing to do, and I think that's a big part of Paul's plan, or at least ends up being a part of his mission.
Is it also taking away some of the original sting of Birth of a Nation? Is it the same way that the people sort of reclaiming the N-word took a lot of the anger out of that?
It's interesting you ask that, because I think Birth of a Nation is one of those classics that almost no one has seen. So it's a kind of real education rather than re-education about it. I think so many people are put off by the movie itself, or have heard about it, and haven't taken the time to look at it, that this is actually a way of drawing attention to what the movie did in the first place.
In a good way or in a bad way, Paul?
I think anytime somebody sees a movie that in its way takes up a huge part, throws such a large shadow on the way the Birth of a Nation does, it's always a good thing. And I think people are frightened off by it, and they have to see it. It is a part of movie history.
Elvis, thanks for being with us. Nice to hear from you.
Thank you.
Elvis Mitchell, former film critic for the New York Times, a visiting lecturer at Harvard University. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Listening to a little bit more of the music, the remix, the rebirth of a nation. It was a silent film. It is not a silent film in the hands of DJ Spooky. We're going to talk a little bit more about the film and where he's going with this kind of stuff when we come back. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. There is a preview of a little bit of music that is not yet on the market. It is part of a soon-to-be-released CD, More Mixes, under the hands of DJ Spooky, a.k.a. The Subliminal Kid, a.k.a. Paul D. Miller. He's here with me in the studio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. This is a collaboration with Dave Lombardo, the wild drummer from the band Slayer, though we're not hearing him in this. Who's the guitar player we're listening to?
Vernon Reed from Living Color.
Okay, all right.
That's a guitar solo.
Did you have fun putting that one together?
Yeah, it was a blast. These are all radically different people. Chuck D from Public Enemy does vocals on the project, and I had some vocal tracks and some instrumental tracks. And the idea around the instrumental tracks is to encourage people to make their own version. So, say, for example, that was this isolated guitar solo. Then I put that between tracks because a lot of kids will then put that in their computer and then mix it themselves over a beat or a rhythm. So part of the album is finished tracks and the other parts are these elements so that people can remix or change the bits and pieces from the album.
And if somebody wanted to use something from one of your CDs for something that they produce, do they have to ask your permission? Do you care about that?
Well, there are some rights reserved, yeah. You know, that's my favorite phrase from Lawrence Lessig's kind of Creative Commons scene. And basically, I'm trying to encourage people to think of DJ culture as 21st century folk culture, meaning exchange is part of the process. And if you think about early forms of folk music, you know, everybody knew the same song, so they could easily just kind of do their own version and without having the FBI show up at your doorstep. But
I don't want to completely leave Rebirth of a Nation, because there's a couple of questions that I still have about that. And one of them is, What is it that you can do with video? I know from seeing parts of what you've done that you overlay circuit boards and use kind of circles and arrows and triangles to direct our attention on the screen. You change black to white the same way we would see it if we looked at a negative photograph, that kind of thing. What are the tools that you have?
Well, it's all done with software editing materials, and not to get too technical, most of the animation is done in 3D vector graphics design programs that let you dig into a scene and really make, what I've done is apply movement schematics and blueprints to each character, so they're assigned a kind of a blueprint or flowchart, so to speak, of their actions. And so to animate that takes a certain program, then to edit it back in takes a certain program. So it's a lot of making these different softwares talk to one another, and you have to edit it. I mean, anybody who's into film knows whenever you finish a scene, you now have to render it. But you have to remember with Griffin, Griffiths, he edited the whole thing by hand using cut-up techniques on celluloid. I'm doing it all digitally.
Now, you make use of some of the most provocative scenes in the film, particularly the Klansmen and the gathering of the clans. I'm wondering, in your choice of that, were you trying to take from Griffith's film what he thought were the high points, or are you trying to change the narrative in your own way?
Well, what's funny, it's great that you bring that up. One of my recent favorite films is called Gunner's Palace, and it's set in Baghdad, and it's a documentary where a filmmaker went and hung out with some of the younger infantrymen in Baghdad. And there's one scene in the film where the soldier's about to raid, and this is real life, actually. I mean, it's a real documentary. Yeah. But they're about to raid a compound of a certain wanted sheikh. And they decide, the tanks have their own sound systems. So they're like, yo, let's do a psyops, dude. You know, you got to remember, these are 18-year-old kids given an M16 and a sound system and a tank. And they're about to raid a compound. So they put on Wagner's Flight of the Valkyries as if they were in the movie Apocalypse Now. And the thing is, Coppola took that from, guess what, Birth of a Nation, because Griffiths had written that during the ride of the Klansmen they should play Wagner. So these kinds of weird kind of connections and tropes seem to keep popping up. And I'm always playing with these, connecting the dots, so to speak, you know?
We're listening to right now a little bit of the music that is used at that point. But when you do this, and I said at the beginning of the program that you've been around the world with Rebirth of the Nation, it's not a track that's now on the film. You're doing the music or the soundtrack live, am I
yeah.
right?
There's a software called Sibelius that lets you simulate strings, and all the strings you hear are programmed. So they're not. There's not a string quartet or a string group playing them, but they sound like strings. So again, the software thing is really great. These days, you can do so much with it.
So if you do Rebirth of the Nation in Paris, for example, are you going to do a different version that you would do if you were doing it at Harvard University or somewhere else in the U.S.?
Yeah, in fact, all of the trade cards we had to translate into French, because you have to remember, I pull up the trade cards to comment on each scene as they're edited. Because with silent film, the characters, obviously, you can't hear them, so they have those little texts, you know. So I'll change the text of the original Griffith and stuff like that. Each city and each version is different. So
and,
it's like,
and the music, you know, do you make that up as you go along? Or you kind of made those kinds of decisions already?
Each version is different. In fact, that's what's been slowing me up from releasing it on DVD, because I'm trying to figure out how to balance the live version versus a kind of a consumer home model, because I want to let people make their own version as well.
1-800-423-8255. Paul D. Miller, a.k.a. DJ Spooky, here with me in the studio. And where are we going? To Providence, Rhode Island. John's with us. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I actually was trying to comment on something that you sort of touched on. I had the privilege of seeing Paul do a live version of the Birth of a Nation in Rhode Island a few months back, and was sort of confused with many of the sort of, I think, principles that I think Paul seems to be trying to emulate and how they are working or sort of not working. And I was sort of confused with the remix in terms of the story and what he was trying to bring to the story. I think that the idea of the performance is really fantastic, and I think that some of the other things he does is great. But this, for me, seemed to be sort of something that really was kind of confusing on the message and what was actually going on.
If you say you're confused, are you saying that whatever was happening up there on the stage didn't make any sense to you?
I kind of felt like there was sort of a sort of ambiguous mix of a live performance and a remix of this sort of monumental historical film that I think that I'm not sure where the connection between hip-hop and the audience that it's being presented to actually comes into play.
Well, the whole idea of hip-hop is, of course, based on what they call break beats. You know, when you break a beat apart is when you create a new version of it. And with sampling, of course, a lot of the early points of hip-hop where they would take an old beat and then loop it and cut it up, it was meant to be recognizable so that people could relate to it, and then somebody would rhyme over it. What I'm doing is the same thing to the film. So some of the issues are leaving elements in place and then changing others. But I like the term that you use, ambiguous, because in a certain sense, that's what it's about. I mean, is it ambiguous for 50 Cent and the G-Unit to have a new album called The Massacre? Or a lot of hip-hop, for example, to call itself, Death Row Records or Murder, Inc.? And at the same time, how much is it around these kinds of pathologies that we've inherited over the last century or so from film? Is it, you know, to be repressed? Is it to be confronted? Is it to be, you know, remixed? These are things that I'm trying to kind of encourage a questioning process. So, yeah, not all answers are written in stone here. It's meant to be ambiguous.
John?
Yes. Well, I kind of feel like there's a sort of maybe a level of sort of intellectual probing into this that you're doing that is sort of not necessarily common within the sort of general population of the hip-hop or even the remix kind of culture, in the sense that what I sort of saw was still basically seemed to be a linear display of this movie with little things that didn't really make a lot of sense mixed in. And you kind of touched on the circuitry and some of that other imagery that was really sort of didn't seem to have a lot to do with the film or seem to create any sort of new narrative that I could then take away from, oh, well, this is what the message is.
Mm-hmm. Well, the circuit...
And I know that there's... And even before seeing this, I had the pleasure of listening to you talk at RISD and sort of talk about your fascination with the message and the media being in the message or the message being in the media. And I'm sort of still confused as to where all this sort of culminates. And in some ways...
What I'm picking up from John here is in a way... almost a sort of, are you over-intellectualizing what's going on in hip-hop, in the DJ mm-hmm. culture, by using words to try and explain it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there's a great sense of irony about these issues, because on one level, of course, the music should just be music, right? But this is something there where I feel like with youth culture and with a lot of the issues around our media at the moment is that everyone just expects you to just sit back and press play. What I do is transform a film and leave elements of it in place and change others, but at the same time, I want the viewers to walk away with multiple perspectives. So, is it over-intellectualizing it? Well, compared to Fox News, yeah. On the other hand, it's like, why not see a different version of things? I like the idea of pushing these things, and I guess I get flack for that a lot, so I'm kind of used to it, but I like the idea of saying, look, this is not with all the answers here. In fact, it asks more questions.
Let's go to Tracy, who's joining us now from Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, Tracy.
Hi. I've not had the fortune to see this film. I guess it's a performance. And the description of it, I'm impressed with how fluid you're making the medium. Film is something I normally think of as a more static art form, and you're taking it and making it a very fluid type of experience. I think that's very innovative and exciting, and I'm hoping that it's something that will catch on the same way that rap music caught on. And I was just wondering about your intention behind choosing that particular film, Birth of a Nation. And so, not knowing what you've actually done with it, I can make some assumptions that, you know, your intention was, you know, using that, reworking the message. But I saw the connection between the innovation that you are making happen and the innovation of the original film itself, just technologically.
Yeah, okay, well, let's work with that. Why this one? Why not the old newsreels from World War One, World War Two, that sort of thing? What was it about Birth of a Nation that drew your imagination?
Well, what I'm really into is how Griffiths was able to, in a certain sense, push a lot of emotional buttons around race and ethnicity. And the controversy of the original film, the way it portrayed a certain two-dimensional aspect of America's strangely hybrid multicultural culture, you know. So, and not saying that I'm a Klansman here. far from. What I'm doing as an African-American confronting this film is thinking about the layers of encoded stereotypes that, and you got to remember, he's the, quote-unquote, the man who invented Hollywood. And that's something that he's been notorious for most of the last century. So thinking of, like, remixing things in general implies, again, what Elvis was talking about earlier, was democratizing culture mm-hmm. and saying, you know, that was one perspective, this is another. And it's the fun part about it is it says there's a lot of different versions. And I think we're going to have to get used to that as the 21st century kicks in further and further, is that there's going to be multiple of everything. Not just one cell phone, but like 500 you can choose from. Not just, you know, five different versions of your TV, but you go into the store and there's 20 zillion versions of anything you can possibly imagine. It's overload. But picking and choosing from it is the fun part at the moment.
And perhaps the another way of helping Tracy with that is to explain to her what the next step is, because the Rebirth of a Nation's part one of what you're hoping will be a trilogy. Your next one's the Leni Riefenstahl film.
Leni Riefenstahl,
right?
Triumph of the Will, yeah. Right now, I have to admit, for the current moment, I'm really intrigued with propaganda and the way it influences public opinion. And as we've seen with the current series of war issues, is where are the weapons of mass destruction? Who's in charge of various issues around how the information gets out? So Leni Riefenstahl is a primary inheritor of a lot of issues Griffiths was dealing with.
She, for people who haven't heard of her, was this classic documentary film producer who followed the rise of the Third Reich and Hitler in quite an adoring way Triumph of the Will, right?
Yeah, and also with Olympia. She was one of the early documentary filmmakers around the Olympics and the way that those were used to, again, nation-state issues, how the sports performers of different countries would operate and stuff. But you got to remember, I'm an artist, and so because of that, I'm always thinking about a lot of issues and trying to work them out in my artwork. So, artists never. It's funny, I've never really met or even heard about an artist who had every answer to every question. I bet you Andy Warhol or Picasso would probably come close to that, but they would always just be a flat kind of projection surface or something, I guess.
1-800-423-8255. You may have questions. You may get answers. You may just get a chance to chat here with DJ Spooky. We're going next to Worcester, Mass., and Kara's on the line. Hi, Kara.
Hi.
Take it away, girl.
My question is, I'm currently working on an honors thesis, and the central idea is that youth culture needs its own voice in the media in order to kind of be less affected by the propaganda of the media at this point. Do you think that that's something that needs to be the direction that we move in our education system? Or,
I mean, in a way, Kara, it's starting to happen already. When you look at the number of people who get their primary news from The Daily Show, which is already taking footage and putting goofy translation over it and changing it in a way from where you might see it on the network, right?
Absolutely. I'm actually looking at a picture of Jon Stewart right now, so it's incredibly appropriate. I guess, especially with the hip-hop culture, do you think, and the caller before that was talking about how he didn't understand the hip-hop in relation to the audience, do you think that branching that kind of culture out that's primarily considered a youth culture and giving that back to the youth and telling them that they can make anything they want out of it is going to create more of a sense of understanding in our culture among youth and adults and create more of a sense of dialogue?
You know, to respond to that, I'm really, the first thing that makes me kind of relate to what you're talking about is that a really interesting album, Danger Mouse, a really interesting DJ did a while ago, where he remixed the Beatles' White Album with Jay-Z's The Black Album and called it Danger Mouse Presents the Gray Album. It was only released on the internet, but it created a huge kind of furor in various copyright law circles. But what I'm thinking about is that as a generational kind of conversation as well, of course, Jay-Z being hip-hop, the Beatles being the sort of the icons of the 60s kind of crowd. But do younger people have their own voice? The answer is of course, and that's where I think we need to understand how digital culture has influenced a whole generation of people to create all sorts of things outside of the normal discourse, so to speak. And that's where everything from blogs to gangs making their own DVDs to, you know, these kinds of terrorist organizations and all these different places making their own propaganda videos and releasing them.
You know, I hadn't even, just until you made that point about the gangs and the Al Jazeera videos and the, you know, the Osama bin Laden tapes that come from the caves, I hadn't made that kind of connection. It's got me thinking.
Well, they're all creating their own, you know, thing.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is you just view it as propaganda. I mean, obviously, it's, but what happens is that I think with contemporary youth culture in the U.S., we're so bombarded with certain kinds of corporate culture in general that I'm not saying that's negative or positive. I just want people to decode it and understand that it's not just a push-button culture. You know?
Back with more of DJ Spooky after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. From frauds, grab the yeses and yours. Who drops the knees to pray to false gods? Who paints this speech competes into the odds? Urban structure designed to make idols from frauds. Grab the yeses and yours. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection this hour. My guest, DJ Spooky, a.k.a. Paul D. Miller, talking a little bit about his new mix of Rebirth of a Nation, which is currently on tour. France and Spain have seen it. Greece and England have yet to see it. And we're talking a little bit about that and the other kinds of things that are going on in his mind as he's doing that. 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK to join us. You know, there was one thing that Kara said just prior to the break that got me wondering whether or not there's a line here in terms of how far you can go in putting information in hip-hop culture before someone goes, whoa, spinach, this is schoolwork, I don't want to do this. You know, it was fun, and now it's not fun anymore.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's you got to remember, all right, there's a big connection between, one, youth cultures where you go to stop thinking and you go to party, right? That's mm-hmm. what's happening. You know, Friday night, you're at the club hanging out, and that's a good dance time. That's cool. I do that too. But for this particular project, the whole idea is to kind of get people to, like you said, eat the spinach and get the, you know, calcium and vitamins. But, you know, my next album is called Drums of Death, and that's with the guys from Slayer and Public Enemy. So, I mean, that's a that's back to the party. So it's for this particular situation, and I have to admit, you know, I'm fascinated with, you know, artsy stuff too, but I also do dance beats and, you know, club stuff.
2005, y'all bounce to this. Do y'all feel it, bruh? Do you feel me? Do you feel me? Come on, brother's gonna feel me. Is you feeling the work it out? Come on.
This is one of the tracks from
Drums of Death.
Drums of Death. This is who we're listening to now?
Chuck D from Public Enemy does vocals for the album.
This is like a 36 second cut here now. What? You're not. When you're putting it together, that you put something like this together, you're putting it there for people to sample, or this is just part of the piece?
The whole idea is kind of, no, it's an album,
yeah.
You know, like a normal record. You
see,
get
I'm never really sure with you whether right. or not it is just an album, right?
No, this is definitely an album, and it's I'm really into a lot of early Public Enemy and the way that Rick Rubin was the producer for them. He was also producing the Beastie Boys and Slayer at the same time, and Slayer was one of the first rock bands on Def Jam. So when I came up with the idea for Drums of Death, I wanted to go back to a certain era in hip-hop, pretty much 1988-89, when you had Tribe Called Quest, Public Enemy, BDP, a lot of great, you know, Eric B. and Rakim, a lot of really good music came out around that time, and I'm kind of looking at Drums of Death as going back to that era.
Was it Chuck D who made that link between, you're going to help me with this, CNN as a sort of, hip-hop as the CNN for young black Americans, or how
young
did he,
people in general, yeah.
But was it just young people in general?
Yeah, yeah. That's a great phrase for him. He says hip-hop is the CNN of urban youth culture. I remember it's like a nice little tag on the scene, but without giving a lot of hype to CNN, I guess I would remix that phrase to just say hip-hop is the network for urban youth culture, you know? And I love the way that you can think of, you know, kind of smoke signals and the Indians used to be able to communicate over the distance. That kind of smoke signal scene here is now migrated to the way people rhyme and what they rhyme about. So while not exactly being 50 Cent here, I guess you can call me the gangsta nerd. But, you know, I don't really rap. What I do is kind of deal with a lot of the issues around the music. So some of it is, yes, like we were talking earlier, the artsy intellectual stuff. And then, of course, like we were just playing, I work with people like Chuck D or Slayer. So
right.
it's totally different in each zone, but that's what makes it fun.
I was going to say, if you get to play in the heavy stuff, you like to have a little bit of the fun stuff at the same time. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
1-800-423-8255. Where are we going next? Cape Cod. Don's on the line. Hi, Don.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'm just wanting. I just love to hear Spooky. I've seen you a couple times. I'm a huge fan of you and the show we're on today. And I just would love to hear you say a word about the underground hip hop culture. And we don't really hear anything about that, but how underground hip hop is about empowering people, women, and the poor, and how you know, the mainstream hip hop is more about empowering great big rims on your car and cribs and all that stuff. And I just, you know, it seems like you're a good representation of the better of the two, and I'd like to hear a couple words about that.
Well, hey, man, thanks for checking the vibe. I mean, I definitely am intrigued with a lot of the issues around the underground. I mean, some of my favorite acts these days are people like Anti-Pop Consortium, Saul Williams, Sarah Jones, There's a new interesting artist out of London named Mia, M-I-A, and she's from Sri Lanka. Her, she rhymes with kind of sort of Indian and also like English style stuff, sort of South Asian hip hop. And there's the whole like Basement Bhangra and like South Asian Indian scene, which is doing some great hip hop as well out of Bombay and New Delhi. I listen to a lot of music from all over, and yeah, you're right. I mean, the corporate style of, you know, huge volume stuff is, but you know what? I mean, there's room for it all. I mean, I really think that what happens now is that the underground versus overground. If you look at Eminem's Mosh video where he was doing this kind of political rhyme, I think that was one of the best tracks on his album, not because it was him rhyming about how he's angry at his mom or anything, but the fact that he was making, you know, some connections between the political process and thinking about, again, hip-hop as a transformative power. But he had a big impact with that, and that's good. But look at Saul Williams, for example. He did a great project called Not In Our Name, which I helped produce. And he read a series of poems at the anti-war rally in Central Park right before the invasion of Iraq. And I think we really do need to see a lot more, again, alternative perspectives. And no other genre has quite as much a commercial orientation as hip-hop. It's like, not only is there's no prohibition against quote-unquote selling out, in fact, it's like, look, why aren't you selling? You know, and it's kind of a paradox, because you want to, you're only as good as your last million double platinum album or something, and as if you're not selling platinum, then all of a sudden you're too artsy or experimental or esoteric. I'd like to champion a lot of the more indie artsy style hip hop, but you know, every blue moon or so, I gotta admit, Snoop Dogg still rocks the joint, and Dr. Dre is just brilliant. So it's hard to front, you know.
Let me ask you something about. It's a piece that you were writing in your book, Rhythm Science, when you were talking about where we all fit in as the consumers and the manipulators of culture. Because I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's in there that when you're talking about how we see this in the iPodding of the country, right, where everybody gets to draw stuff from wherever they want and pack it into their own little piece. The thing about that I didn't get is that the iPod as a playback tool is a very personal and individual thing. There's relatively no communication going on. I mean, imagine a bus or a subway with everybody listening to their iPod and there's nobody talking, right? I'm not sure where it goes from there. Does it mean that it becomes more and more private? And if so, how does it become more public, a more sort of social thing?
Well, I mean, there's only so much bass in your iPod headphones. Let's put it that way. I mean, I think people really like to go and hear music loud sometime. You know, it doesn't. Yeah. But you're right. It's this kind of personalizing of their whole musical aesthetic, and you just put the headphones on, and everybody else vanishes. You know, but that's with the same case with the Walkman. But what difference? You know, the difference between the Walkman and the iPod is, of course, you make your own playlist, you make your own remixes of how the sequence of songs on an album goes, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that that's definitely a jump-off point for the rest of probably the next 10 years of how people are going to think about media in general, whether it's TiVo that lets you edit out TV commercials and so you can just watch this show, you know, stuff like that, is the picking and
choosing.
Which
will be on your iPod so you can sit on the subway and watch that show.
They have visual iPods coming out. Yeah, you know, so it's pretty intense. I mean, you got to remember, I started this as a kind of a fun art project. It was never meant to be my main thing. But somehow the culture at large just in the last 10 years, I remember when I went to Bowdoin up in Maine, we barely had internet on campus. We had Telnet. And then, you know, I went back a while ago and they had wireless networks everywhere. You could just take your computer out and sit on the steps on campus and just, you know, it's been 10 years. I haven't used a typewriter in years, let alone, what else? Like, just a fax. I haven't sent a fax.
I used to work on a telex machine. I don't even want to get into that.
But it's been pretty quick, man. I mean, you know.
It's amazing. 1-800-423-8255. And to Britt, Iowa. Ben's on the line. Hi, Ben.
Hey, what's up, DJ Spooky? Longtime fan. How's it going?
Hey.
I guess I just, like, my major question is, a lot of people talk about Paul's Boutique by the Beastie Boys and how it's so sample-ridden and they left so much stuff that nowadays, an album like that could never be produced again just due to copyright. I just wanted to know what your thoughts on that was and, like, mass media sharing, say, like, the whole Napster file sharing routine.
Yeah.
And, like, how hard it is to work on a project like this.
Well, yeah, I mean, the good part about Birth of a Nation is that it's made in 1915, so it's just out of the control mechanisms of copyright control law. So I'm going to release elements of it online. In fact, I already have some on my website at djspooky.com that allow people to make their own versions of the film. And, yeah, I mean, copyright law as it stands now is pretty intense about almost anything that you could possibly sample. One of my favorite theoreticians of that is Lawrence Lessig, and he blurbed my book, Rhythm Science. But the way he's come up with Creative Commons, which is a great sort of website that gives you some really good insight in terms of how copyright law affects sampling and media control mechanisms around if you put a clip of anything, whether it's a video clip or a sound clip, you know, they're going to definitely be a lot of people out there watching. The idea, of course, is to transform it so that it's no longer recognizable. Getting sued is a real drag. So I always edit and transform almost anything I work on to the point where I'm hoping that if various copyright control people hear it, it just slips through the control. But, you know, the Danger Mouse critique, you know, where he mixed the Black Album with the White Album, you know, it's a great kind of jump-off point for that. But how we think of sampling is, you know, just beginning to really filter out in terms of the legal system, trying to understand it and control it. But it keeps, if you think about how people live, everybody's making their own mixes, their own versions. It just depends on how official the release is. Like if you make a mix CD for your friends at home and they pass it around, you don't have to deal with anything. But if I release it on an album, I'll have lawyers beating down my door in a second, you know.
All right, Ben, djspooky.com, there's a link to that on our website in case you're driving and you can't write it down. You know where we are. We're at theconnection.org, 1-800-423-TALK. Boston next, and Ken's with us. Hi, Ken.
Hello there.
Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
Well, I realize that sometimes you get an idea or you think of something that was, 3 minutes ago on your show, but you were talking about the iPod and its pervasivity now.
Yeah, take us back there. What about it?
Well, it's what I discovered, and this is through an event that took place up, in Cambridge at Harvard Square near the T-stop. And there were a bunch of people who had their iPods, you know, plugged into their ears, and there were I don't know, 50 or 60 people iPod connected, but they were all tuned into one of these wireless units, and so they're all listening to the same music, and they're dancing. Of course, anybody observing saw only the people dancing, and it was like...
But couldn't hear anything, right?
No, the observer.
Yeah, right.
Couldn't hear anything. But even in this sort of independent or personalized space, people wanted to share the same music and you know, share that same value or dance to it together. So, you know, I thought, well, you know, there's an element to this that actually includes, you know, the group or the community.
Yeah, you see, there I am, hung up on my nose. The iPod is an intensely personal thing.
Well, I think that must have looked pretty wild. Sometimes when I see people, you know, you're walking down the street and you hear somebody talking really loud and it looks like they're talking to themselves, it looks like they're kind of like a crazy person, and you realize they have a little cell phone thing in their ear. It's the same kind of strangeness. I mean, I'm fascinated with the way over the last couple years this kind of iPod headphones thing. In New York, at least, so many people are walking around with headphones. It's kind of funny. Like you'll see a car where somebody's on their cell phone, and then the car bumps into somebody who's just walking across the street with their headphones on and didn't notice the car. I think they're trying to actually make, like, the no-smoking thing in New York. Do you guys have that here?
Yeah, oh, yeah, completely.
All right. They're trying to make a no-cell-phone-in-your-car kind of thing. But at the end of the day, how much... this influences our human social patterns is what fascinates me. I think more and more you're going to see over the next couple of years is whether it's satellite radio, that's, you know, like Howard Stern's taking his whole radio show because he's been getting hassled by the FCC.
The show's on satellite radio. A lot of them are going up there now.
Yeah. But between that and the way people are even making iPod broadcasts and wireless networks available, like Philadelphia is now going to be one of the first cities to have a whole wireless network over the whole city. So you won't deal with radio almost... If you think about it at all, you just check into any wireless hub anywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's going to influence everything from how people transform files and send files back and forth to how they watch TV. Because obviously you can just get the wireless signal from, you know, whatever server instead of turning it to old, you know, networks. Very 21st century, that's all I can say.
Is it all, though, can you put it all under the heading of some kind of a narrative? I remember in Rhythm Science you saying that DJing is writing and writing is DJing, and that's all a part of either creating or studying or reading or listening to your own or someone else's narrative. Does it fit? Is that something that...
Yeah, I mean, well, you got to remember, all right, I did 2 degrees, one in philosophy, the other in French literature, and this is where I might get the over-intellectualizing thing coming up here.
No, that's okay. I asked for it. I'm curious to know here.
All right, if we look at the 70s and the 60s, where you had people like Marsha McLuhan theorizing the idea of the global village, the idea here of the medium is the massage, then you look at Jacques Derrida and Roland Barthes and their whole critique of the death of the author, the erasure of certain kinds of text, you know, that kind of academic critique of the writing process has now come home to roost in electronic culture, where you're always editing, erasing tracks, skipping from website to website. You're never really, the hypertextual jump cut, you know, where you jump, you know, you click on a link. That's the same equivalent of what these theoreticians were talking about earlier, but it's come now out of technology.
And so where does it end up in science fiction? Because that's one of the lines that you draw, which amuses me.
Well, I'm a huge Philip K. Dick fan, and this is very Philip K. Dick era. I mean, the president could be a character out of some crazy Blade Runner novel or something. I don't know. Oh, man. But, it's funny. I've been rereading some of his stuff, it's The Man in the High Castle. Do you ever read Philip K. Dick?
No, I don't know his writing.
He wrote the script that eventually became Blade Runner.
Right, okay.
A lot of his stuff is uncertainty about who's human, who's a copy, who controls memory, stuff like that. And between him and another one of my favorite writers, William Gibson, there's a great phrase out of William Gibson's, he coined the term cyberspace, for example. He says, the future's already here, it's just unevenly distributed. Which is a great kind of way of thinking about these fragments of different time periods we have going on now. I remember when they made a copy of Dolly the Sheep, you know, I was like, well, that's a remix right there. Right? You know? But it's definitely, even 10 years ago, who would have guessed that all these wireless networks and stuff are going to be popping up in such an interesting way? But that's what makes it very, as the Chinese say, very interesting times.
Yeah, well, it's a little hard to keep up with. It's interesting to have someone like yourself who's actually working at that to spend a few moments with us to tell us what's on your mind. I want to thank you for coming in. It was nice to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
DJ Spooky, a.k.a. The Subliminal Kid, a.k.a. Paul D. Miller. Earlier in the hour, a couple of words with Elvis Mitchell, visiting lecturer at Harvard University and entertainment critic for NPR's Weekend Edition. For more on DJ Spooky's music and art and film, you can find links to what he's up to at our website, weareattheconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.